ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
For decades, a mystery has haunted Tamworth.
Mark Anthony Haynes' body was discovered on an isolated stretch of train tracks.
No one talked about him because he was just another little black fella.
An ABC True Crime podcast was followed by a fresh inquest.
Tom was just holding their breath.
If he didn't do it directly, he knows what happened.
With the truth closer than ever, hear the whole story now. Search for Unravel Blood on the Tracks. It's on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, coming to you from Gadigal land. Over 50 years ago, an MIT student called Joseph Stiglitz wrote his doctoral thesis on inequality. In the years since, much has happened to Joseph Stiglitz, including winning the Nobel Prize. But he remains fascinated by inequality, now a yawning gulf between rich and poor. Stiglitz just published a new study of inequality and its impact on the world, and he is my guest later in the show. But first, a week ago, out of nowhere, Donald Trump signaled that the United States would, after 30-something years, resume nuclear testing. Other US officials have walked that back a bit, but it comes as an unhappy reminder that nuclear weapons remain one of the most urgent unsolved problems of the world. As Gareth Evans writes in the latest issue of Australian Foreign Affairs, the outlook ranges from desolate to hopeless. The important arms control agreements of the past are dead, dying, or on life support. And the recent behaviour of the actors that matter most, the United States, Russia, and China, has fed concerns that things can only get worse. Post-Parliament, Gareth Evans has spent much of his energies campaigning to avert nuclear catastrophe. First as president and CEO of the Brussels-based International Crisis Group, lately as the founding convener of the Asia-Pacific Leadership Network for Nuclear Non-Proliferation and Disarmament. He has also continued to write on the subject, and the paper that he's just published in Australian Foreign Affairs is called Doomsday Diplomacy: Australia Can Lead a New Arms Control Push. Gareth joins me from Melbourne. Gareth, welcome to the show.
My pleasure, David.
Is there still a thing called the Doomsday Clock, and are they still adjusting it? And if so, where are we?
Well, it's the rhetorical device employed by the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists. And it's now, I think, I've forgotten how many seconds to midnight, but it's the closest to midnight that it's been since the clock was originally set several decades ago. And that reflects the reality that after a period of some confidence that we were moving away from the crazy arms racing of the Cold War years to a more sober appreciation of the problems of nuclear weapons, it reflects the reality that we now have a situation where, as you said in your intro, all the existing and familiar arms control, nuclear arms control agreements of recent decades are either dead or dying or on life support, and where we've got the major nuclear players all engaged in outright increases in their stockpiles, particularly in the case of China, or significant modernization of them. Plus, you've got a situation where recently in the context of Ukraine, Putin has made it pretty clear that he doesn't feel as constrained as he might, as others might have in the past, with the nuclear taboo, so-called, and does see the possibility of the actual use, not just the threat of use of nuclear weapons. And in a context where all this is happening, and our various intelligence and defence agencies and some of those who drink similar Kool-Aid getting very excited about potential threats from China in particular, the risks of all this turning pear-shaped are pretty significant.
Why has this drift back to nuclear renewal? Why has that happened? Surely, essentially, the world was very happy with the notion that the puff had gone out of all of this nuclear confrontation.
Well, I fear there's a sort of complacency that having lived for 80 years without it happening, despite so many reminders from so many people that it could happen, there's just a degree of complacency that this is just a doomsday scenario. There's not might be theoretically possible, but is not actually going to happen. And I think in that context, it's very easy to stumble into a kind of indifference to the need to be constantly pursuing either, if not outright elimination, certainly effective non-proliferation and certainly nuclear risk reduction. There just doesn't seem to be the same kind of momentum. We haven't had the leadership we need also from critical leaders. You did have it to some extent from Obama and Biden, who seemed to recognize the problem and the need to do something about it. But now, of course, with Trump, who's all over the place, as you began by saying, even with this extraordinary recent opening up again of the option of possible nuclear testing, you've got American leadership all over the place. You've got the Russians, as I've said, actively undermining or degrading the nuclear taboo. And you've got the Chinese pursuing nuclear build-up, not, I think, with any particular aggressive intent, more defensive, but nonetheless creating an environment in which it seems that, you know, most bets are off. You've got Israel still pretending not to have any nuclear weapons at all and behaving very badly in so many other ways, as we know. You've got India and Pakistan constantly on the brink of further conflict with, you know, real concern that nuclear weapons might be deployed, but somehow it just doesn't seem to have caught the popular imagination, the political imagination.
Let's go to the absolute basic of this. Surely anybody knows that if they push the button to send a nuclear weapon across the world, they are committing suicide.
I think that's the reality, and that's why I say that most of the really extreme scenarios of latter-day Strangelove or Kim Jong-il in Korea actually pressing the button and initiating an aggressive first use, I think that is implausible. But it's also the reason why most of the arguments for the necessity of having nuclear weapons as a deterrent, for example, you know, vulnerable states without nuclear weapons now feeling that they need them in order to beat off the possibility of some regime-changing assault from a nuclear weapons power. I mean, that's where your point, you know, becomes very relevant indeed. If a Ukraine had kept its nuclear weapons rather than giving them up at the end of the Cold War, would it be remotely credible for Ukraine to be using them in the context of resisting the Russian cross-border aggression? No, because to do so would be manifestly suicidal. If North Korea were to use nuclear weapons from the handful that it has in its present stockpile against South Korea or anybody else, I mean, it would be reduced, if not by nuclear weapons, then certainly by the conventional capability of the United States and others. I mean, Pyongyang would be reduced to a car park within 5 minutes. And it is a suicidal enterprise, and it's crazy under those circumstances to believe that there's any real rational utility in retaining these things, particularly when the risk of just having them just through misreading of an emerging situation or system error or human error, miscalculation, misjudgment, moving into a full-scale nuclear exchange, which would, of course, have not only catastrophic humanitarian consequences, because these are the most indiscriminately inhumane weapons ever devised, but also catastrophic consequences for the planet and life on the planet as we know it. So it's really, really important just to keep people's minds concentrated on what the real issue is here and not to get carried away by the spurious psychological comfort that nuclear weapons or the prospect of acquiring nuclear weapons seems to give so many people in high office.
Another drawback with nuclear weapons, surely, is that you can't use them nearby. And for Putin to say, look, we might drop a bomb on Ukraine, is just manifestly ridiculous, because the wind will blow all the shit back on Russia. Ditto, Israel can't drop a nuclear bomb on any neighbour of theirs. They can't drop a nuclear bomb on Gaza.
No, that's absolutely right. And that's, again, one of the rational reasons why the whole enterprise is sort of nonsensical. I mean, the whole thing is just crafted on the notion, I suppose, that even if these things are never used, the possession of them is some kind of effective deterrent. But, you know, weapons that are not actually usable for the reasons we've just been talking about, what sort of deterrent does that actually amount to? The post-Cold War, well, recent decades have been littered with instances of non-nuclear states actually attacking nuclear states in the Falklands War and Korean Wars, Vietnam Wars and so on, without any real belief that there would be nuclear consequences by doing so. The whole thing is a sort of an illusion piled upon an illusion piled upon an illusion. But it's not a harmless illusion. It's a very dangerous illusion because of the prospects of things careering very rapidly out of control. And this notion of the potential for accidental use is not just, you know, academic or pretense. I mean, I can identify, if we had time, a dozen instances.
Well, let's explore a few of them, because when I read your essay, they really alarmed me.
Yeah, well, I mean, during the Cold War years, you had the classic situation of the Cuban missile contest in the early 60s, when it was only the fact of the happenstance presence of a third senior Soviet official on a submarine in Caribbean waters that stopped them responding to a perceived attack on that submarine with a nuclear torpedo, thus triggering World War III. There was that situation, but then we've had alarms of incoming missile barrages being triggered in the United States by a military exercise tape being mistakenly fed into the live warning system. That was in 1979. We had the failure of a single computer chip generating an impression of a nuclear invasion in 1980, twice in that year. We had in the Soviet Union in 83, officials misreading sunlight on high altitude clouds as being evidence of a nuclear launch. And in the post-Cold War years, it still continued. In 1995, Yeltsin in Russia was advised to retaliate immediately against an incoming NATO missile, which proved to be a Norwegian scientific rocket. 2007, you had the craziness
stop,
of...
Stop,
stop! Well, it just goes on and on and on. You had the, you know, six nuclear weapons being loaded by the US into a plane on the tarmac somewhere in the US, and people not realizing that it happened. It was flying around the country for 6 days without anyone noticing.
And left overnight unguarded on an airstrip somewhere.
And then you had 2022, an Indian missile crashing into Pakistani territory, the result of human error by a launch crew, but in the absence of any effective hotline communication between military leaders, triggering a high alert response, which could easily have gone totally nuclear pear-shaped. And again, there's another similar instance earlier just this year. So year after year after year, case after case after case, you've got this hard evidence of being absolutely on a knife edge in terms of things, you know, potentially going pear-shaped, and it being a matter of, as I keep writing, sheer dumb luck, not human sense or system sense, but sheer dumb luck that we've avoided that catastrophe.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I am talking to Gareth Evans about the essay he's just published in Australian Foreign Affairs. Gareth, you argue that the existence of nuclear weapons actually encourages the build-up of conventional weapons. Now, have I got that right?
Well, I'm just saying it doesn't guarantee that won't happen. And there is there's an argument that the presence of nuclear weapons makes the world safe for conventional war, because the nature of triggering a nuclear response is so extreme and so unlikely because of the respective consequences for both sides, that gives potential players the opportunity and the excuse to be very creatively antagonistic without using nuclear weapons. And some, the Kargil case in India and a whole bunch of the ones that I've already mentioned in passing involve people playing war games with each other in the expectation that they can go a long way in generating military kinetic results without triggering a nuclear response from the other side. So I'm not saying that nuclear weapons encourage the build-up of conventional weapons, but they certainly don't ensure that conventional weapons won't be used. If anything, the contrary has shown to be the case in recent decades.
Is it clear who in the United States would press the button?
Well, it remains the president. That decision is his. One can only hope that in a situation of potential craziness by the president, or impulsiveness or overreaction or whatever, that cooler military heads around him would somehow, you know, find it possible to either ignore or countermand such an order coming down. But it's a very fragile basis on which to vest your hopes. And when you've got people in office as impulsive and as ignorant and as indifferent to, you know, rational advice as someone like Trump currently in the White House, the guarantee that in the short decision frame that would be involved in the event of a perceived evidence of an incoming nuclear attack, the notion that in the very short time window involved you'd get a completely rational, you know, response is something to be optimistic about, but not to be confident about.
Yeah, Gareth, how is it that Israel has been allowed to build up a substantial nuclear arsenal while standing completely to one side of all of the treaty processes surrounding nuclear weapons, and indeed to be able to pretend officially that it doesn't have nuclear weapons? I mean, how has this been allowed?
Well, it does defy credibility, and I think the only reason it's been allowed over the years is because of a sense, not just from successive United States administrations, but others, that if there's an overt acknowledgement of Israel's nuclear capability, it would prove politically impossible for some of its Arab neighbours to avoid, you know, following suit. They'd have to satisfy their own domestic constituencies by not allowing that to happen. That's a pretty implausible sort of response these days when it's so universally acknowledged that Israel is and has been for many decades now a nuclear power. How you describe them getting away with it is a very good question. But certainly it's universally acknowledged in the analytical literature that they're a fully fledged nuclear armed state like the other eight we now have.
And what's your prediction for the ultimate outcome of the bombing of Iran's nuclear facilities?
Well, there's obviously the prospect that Iran will believe that it now has no option whatsoever but to race for a bomb, and it is only a few months away from doing that, even with the destruction of some of its facilities and some of its fissile material, presumably. I think I'm less pessimistic about that happening than I was not so long ago. I think the reality is such is the degree of intelligence penetration of the Iranian system by Israel in particular, such is the degree of probability that anything that Iran did to start moving physically towards building a bomb, such is the probability that would be greeted immediately by yet another major military attack by Israel and possibly supported by the US, that I think it is a bit unlikely. I should say about Iran, I've been working on the Iran brief for a long, long time, or I did work during my active years when I was particularly at the International Crisis Group in the first decade of the century. I spent a lot of time being a kind of a back channel between Iran and the United States in the developing concept of what became the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, which the US unfortunately later tore up. It was an environment in which the United States wasn't talking to Tehran at all, and in which the Europeans were talking to Tehran but weren't listening. And the reality was that I never really believed, after having a lot of conversations with senior Iranian players, I never really believed that they were actually committed to acquiring a weapon. Certainly they wanted to be seen to be having that capability. Certainly they wanted to be able to thumb their noses at the US and say, yes, don't assume that we can't. But they knew always the downside risks that were involved. And there was also a sort of a religious dimension to it, which has been sort of underappreciated, I think. If we've got a second, I can tell you a story which I think is very revealing in that respect. I was in Tehran having dinner with a group of senior officials, including a little whiskery, Revolutionary Guard character sitting beside me, frayed shirt collar and all the rest. And he was wheezing his way through the dinner. And I said to him at one stage, you don't sound very well. And he said, well, I'm not very well because I was gassed by the Iranians during the recent war. And not wanting to miss an opportunity to make a point, I said, well, under those circumstances, you can't possibly want to be again in a position of not having a similar weapon of mass destruction of your own to ensure that you're not subject to that kind of assault. And instead of just taking that as the kind of debating point that it was, this little guy got incredibly angry, just really genuinely angry, not theatrically angry, but genuinely angry, saying, you don't understand, you and the West don't understand. The fatwa that's been announced by our leaders reflects the reality that God Almighty, Allah bless his name, finds it absolutely unconscionable that we should ever be guilty of using or threatening to use such an outrageously inhumane weapon. And there's little echoes of this periodically over the years, but people have not given, I think, you know, credit to that. Such has been the enthusiasm for demonising the Iranians at every possible step.
Yeah. Why hasn't the Albanese government signed and ratified the UN Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons? Albanese said he was going to. Why hasn't it happened?
Well, the reality is to do so would immediately mean, in effect, the end of the US-Australia alliance as it presently stands, because the Nuclear Ban Treaty, the TPNW, Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, bans absolutely its treaty members from doing anything at all to assist a nuclear weapons power in the management or operation of its nuclear weapons system. And of course, we're up to our eyeballs in assisting the US in that respect, traditionally through the Pine Gap facility, which is highly relevant for intelligence gathering, targeting, and God knows what else in a nuclear warfare context. But also increasingly, of course, now with the AUKUS arrangement, where there's multiple other layers of very visible assistance to the American warfighting, nuclear warfighting capability, which we're getting ourselves ever more immersed in. So for all the grandeur of our commitment as a party to signing and ratifying the treaty, it's never really been very plausible that we would. I should say that the treaty itself is far more sort of aspirational than operational. It's got all sorts of flaws in terms of its lack of verification provisions, its lack of enforcement provisions, the time-bound constraint that it sets on moving to zero in a way that any cautious nuclear-armed power would be very, very reluctant to commit itself to without the guarantee of effective enforcement against rogue state breakout. There are all sorts of problems with the treaty, and I think it is a bit regrettable that we pretended to completely support it while always knowing that the price of actually supporting it, actually signing it, actually ratifying it would be to tear up the defence alliance with the United States. And while some people might still want to argue to this day that that's something wholly to be desired, it's a hell of a big step to take in the context of buying into a treaty which, frankly, is of not much operational utility at all, even though it is intellectually, normatively, morally an important step forward.
But would any treaty, if word came that a missile was on its way, would any treaty hold anybody back from retaliating?
Well, if they retain their weapons, have that capacity, and there's a weapon on its way, and they're confident in the intelligence, which is a big ask as to where the weapon came from and what its impact is likely to be, no, it's not going to hold them back. But there is a sense in which treaties are not worthless. There is a very strong, imperative in international relations, if you have actually bought into a treaty, to be prepared to observe its constraints. And one of the reasons why the Americans have not actually signed the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, even though up until now at least they've been strong supporters of it, is that they know that to sign it would be to be absolutely constrained, and even under sort of Trumpian-type administration, that does seem to be something of an inhibition.
Even though, as you said a moment ago, we're up to our necks in this, you argue that it would be possible for Australia to exert some soft power, at least, to try to fix some of the dangers here. How?
Well, we've done that in the past. I mean, under the Keating government, at the end of that period, we did establish the Canberra Commission on the abolition of elimination of nuclear weapons. And that was the first really big international enterprise in establishing clearly the problems associated with nuclear weapons retention by anyone, with that famous mantra that we articulated that, so long as any state has nuclear weapons, others will want them. So long as anyone has them, they're likely one day to be used, if not deliberately, then by accident, misadventure. And any such use would be catastrophic for life on this planet as we know it. That was a very big normative step forward, and that was driven wholly by Australia. Again, we've played a big role in the extension permanently of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Richard Butler, of blessed memory, as our ambassador, was very, very effective internationally in making that happen. We played a big role under the Howard government, I have to acknowledge, in getting the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty out of a rut in which it was stuck in Geneva into the UN General Assembly and actually being there formally endorsed. We played under the Rudd administration a significant role in with the establishment of the International Commission, the Australia-Japan Commission on Nuclear Non-Proliferation Disarm, which I co-chaired with my former foreign minister counterpart from Japan. And that was an important step forward in articulating for the whole world a course of action in terms of nuclear risk minimization, which, you know, had its obvious policy attractions and utility. So we've been there in the past. We've been significant players with our voice taken seriously, and we can be again. How much difference it would make in terms of the actual big goal of global zero, getting rid of nuclear weapons completely, is, you know, of course, arguable, but it's no reason for our voice not being heard. In terms of continuing to support non-proliferation to new players in the scene and all the things that are necessary to create a competing dynamic to that, our voice is very important, has always been important, always been listened to in that context. And in terms of nuclear risk reduction, I think we have a particularly important role to play when it comes to doing perhaps what I've argued would be the most useful single thing to generate nuclear risk reduction, and that is to get universal embrace of a principle of no first use. And in the past, Australia has not been helpful in advancing that cause when, as I might have mentioned, Obama and Biden were keen to go down that particular path.
But we didn't back them.
We didn't back them any more than the European allies wouldn't back them and our Northeast Asian allies and partners of the US wouldn't back them. They wanted to keep open the option of first use, God help us. But Australia's voice, had it been heard then loudly and clearly, as I hope it will be in the future, would have been hugely relevant in giving the Americans some confidence that they could go down that path without generating adverse consequences. So in all of that, I've also argued in this paper that it really would be helpful in respect if Albo, as Prime Minister, were to take the opportunity to make a really big speech, not in the not-too-distant future, bringing together all these threads, explaining why it is that this is still such a critically troubling issue, and explaining what it is that we as Australians can possibly do to reduce the risks that are involved.
If not to,
big conceptual speeches of that kind don't seem to be our present government's forte, but they do matter in changing the community sense of what's important and generating an impression for us internationally of the kind of good international citizen role that we have played very successfully in the past.
Gareth, thanks for coming on the show.
My pleasure, David.
I've been talking to Gareth Evans, who these days is Distinguished Honorary Professor of the Australian National University and author of a paper in Australian Foreign Affairs, Doomsday Diplomacy, Australia Can Lead a New Arms Control Push, and Australian Foreign Affairs, of course, is up there available online. This is Late Night Live. Coming up, Joseph Stiglitz and the Global Emergency of Inequality. When the richest nations in the world meet at the G20 summit in Johannesburg the weekend after next, they'll have in their kits a report on global inequality prepared for them by a team of independent experts led by the renowned economist Joseph Stiglitz. It's the first report of its kind ever. The prose is calm, but the conclusions are dire. Inequality, they write, is one of the most urgent concerns in the world today, generating many other problems in economics, societies, politics, and the environment. Among their findings is that inequality has become dramatically worse in the last 25 years around the world,
with the top 1% capturing 41% of the globe's new wealth in that time. Joseph Stiglitz, Nobel laureate, former chief economist at the World Bank and professor at Columbia University, joins me from New York. Joseph, welcome to the show.
Nice to be here.
Joseph, in short, how has it come to this? Why has inequality become so dramatically expanded in the last 25, 30 years?
Well, that was one of the questions our commission looked at. Much of it is that we haven't undertaken the kind of policies that would curb it. We allowed market power to grow. We made our tax systems less progressive. We weakened labor market support. We weakened corporate governance laws. So there's a whole host of things that have contributed to the huge inequality that we have today. And that's why one of our important points that we make is inequality is a choice. Inequality is not a result of the laws of nature. It's a result, really, of the laws of man, and that we have not done what we could do to curb it.
But inequality is the ordinary state of societies, isn't it? Societies have always been unequal, and those who have power have always wished to preserve that inequality, haven't they? Why is it that things have got so extraordinarily out of whack now?
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. You know, in the Bible, it talks about the poor you shall always have with you. But the extremes of inequality, the numbers that you mentioned, the corresponding part of the number that you mentioned was the bottom 50% of our world's population has gotten 1% of the increase in global wealth over the last 25 years. I think what we are now recognizing is that this inequality is a threat. Our commission began by thinking that it was a threat to our economy, and it is undermining our economic performance. But there was even a stronger feeling that it was a threat to our society and to our politics, that it has fed into the democratic backsliding that we're seeing in so many countries.
But what we're also seeing is that the same forces that have produced these unequal societies are harnessing the resentment of those who've done worst out of them in order to consolidate their power. How do we, I mean, I don't know whether you agree with that paradox, but if you do, how do we address that paradox?
I do agree with that paradox. And one of the strong sentiment of our committee, and maybe the most important recommendation, is that if there is better knowledge of the extent of inequality, the drivers of inequality, and that we can do something about it, the policies will change. If people really understand that people at the top are paying lower tax rates than those below, they'll change those policies. So our recommendation is that there be created a independent international panel on inequality, a panel of experts that, like the IPCC, gathered information about climate change. It's had an enormous impact on our understanding of climate change and what we can do about it. Our hope would be sort of a model that by enhancing understanding of inequality in all its dimensions and how inequality is in income and wealth are related to inequalities in health and access to justice and opportunity, that we will actually encourage society to begin to address this major problem that we are facing today.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Joseph Stiglitz about the report on global inequality that is to be discussed at the G20 summit in Johannesburg in a couple of weeks' time. Joseph, when we were talking a moment ago, you listed many of the things that have been done and undone that have caused this widening gulf of inequality. We might give them the rough title of neo-economics, the notion of getting rid of the rules, letting things flourish of their own accord, free markets. And I wonder whether you can see where that thinking came from. Was it just a ploy of the rich?
Well, it was largely a ploy of the rich. The idea that if you stripped away regulations, whether it was regulations for pollution, for the environment, or banking regulation, it would unleash market forces, and we would see unprecedented growth from which everybody would benefit through a mysterious process called trickle-down economics.
Yes, that money was going to, of its own accord, trickle down into other people's hands. I'd always thought money was sucked up, but this idea was that it would trickle down.
Exactly. And we've now had 45 years of that experiment. When I say experiment, let me add that at the time this began, we had ample evidence and theory that it was not going to work. And that's why I say it was partly foisted on the world by those whose interest it was in. But with 45 years of this experiment, growth is slower. And there was no trickle down. It was trickle up. The people at the top did very, very well. I mean, today, just this week, Elon Musk got a $1 trillion pay package.
Oh, but Joseph, to be fair, he has to fulfill some KPIs, doesn't he?
That's right.
Yes.
That's right.
But then he gets $1 trillion, yes.
Exactly. And whether he is the source of the gain or whether it's because the economy does well or maybe even because inflation is high, he can get that $1 trillion. But the point I wanted to make was really not so much his particular package, but to frame it as, can you realize, understand how many of the world's problems could be solved with a fraction of that $1 trillion? The scourge of lack of literacy on part of so many people around the world in the poor countries, people dying, children dying of lack of health care. Those problems could be easily solved if we had just a fraction of that amount of money.
Joseph, are you talking about the United States when you write in the report, in countries where campaign contributions play a more important role, the rich can in effect buy themselves into power?
It was obviously something that we were thinking about, particularly true of the United States, because our Supreme Court, in a famous case called Citizens United, basically gave the wealthy, the corporations, unbridled powers to contribute. And contributions are maybe not the right word. It's really an investment in the political process from which they have been able to get enormous returns. We saw it in the banking sector, where deregulation generated huge profits, eventually leading to the worst financial crisis in 75, 80 years. But we also see it in the tech sector, where the failure to address their monopoly power, their lack of accountability for the social harms that they are doing, have bought them unprecedented profits, but at the expense of the rest of our society.
I think you may also be talking about the United States as well, when you make the point that it's not inequality as such that produces bad politics, bad societies, but it's the capacity of those with wealth to get what they want. It's not a statistical thing that leads to this, but it's a structural thing that leads to the decay of politics.
That's right. Although, you know, let me emphasize that one of the things we pointed out is that many of the sources of inequality represent distortions in our economy. So if you allow market power, you undermine competition, you undermine innovation, you lead to a higher prices, which is equivalent to saying workers' real wages adjusted for inflation are lower. So one of the things that we point out is that addressing inequality, and particularly some of the most pernicious sources of inequality, can actually lead to not only a more just society, greater equality, but also a better performing economy. So the old view that you could only reduce inequality at the cost of poor economic performance has now been overturned by research over the last 20 years, showing that actually equality-enhancing policies can actually be performance-enhancing policies.
And this is to counter the argument that red tape always strangles.
Absolutely. And an obvious example is you can have simple regulations about pollution, no coal-fired power plants. That's not red tape, but it means that you have better environmental policies, better climate. People with asthma don't die. We don't have to spend as much money repairing the damage of extreme weather events that are associated with climate change. So we can actually save money rather than repairing damage by investing in our people, in our infrastructure, in our technology. So a major message of our report is that pro-equality policies are actually can be better for our economy and for our society, not just for our politics.
Is dealing with climate change, in your view, the principal battlefield in the world today between money and good sense?
Well, it's one of the battlefields. Inequality.
There are a few, I have to admit.
It is another. That's, you know, we say people are finally waking up to our climate emergency. And the point of our report is to wake people up to the inequality emergency that we are having. And just like a key part of the response to the climate emergency was the creation of this independent panel called IPCC, which has been so influential, we took that idea and said, what we really need today is an IPI, an International Panel on Inequality. When we gave our report, presented our report to President Ramaphosa in Cape Town, he expressed enormous enthusiasm for this. And as we've talked to people all over the world, there is a really a shared enthusiasm, not only among researchers in inequality, workers in inequality, but among political leaders. So I really hope that at the Leaders Summit in Johannesburg at the end of this month, they will set in motion efforts to make sure this happens.
I absolutely admire your argument that if we know, we will change. But there is so much experience, is there not, in the last decades, of knowing perfectly well how terrible various policies are, knowing perfectly well what their impact is going to be, but still we find ourselves going down those roads. Is knowing going to be enough?
No, knowing is not going to be enough, but I think knowing is absolutely essential, and I really think knowing really does help. Over the last 30, 35 years, knowledge about climate change has succeeded in making a difference. Almost all of the world today is united behind climate change. When I was on the IPCC, which I was in the second assessment back in 1995, the first time the economic and social dimensions of climate change were addressed, it was really hard to stir up interest in climate change. There were even some economists who said, well, having a little bit warmer weather might be good.
Yes, I remember that.
And we, our work was at that point saying, you know, it's not just an increase in temperature by 1 or 1.5 or 2 degrees. It's the incidence of extreme weather events. And lo and behold, over the next 25 years, we began to see more and more evidence of these extreme weather events. And so that knowledge is really, you know, and we can now say we understand why that's happening. It's not just an accident. We are to blame for these extreme weather events. And the same thing, I believe, is happening in the case of inequality. And that's why our knowledge, a better knowledge base would help.
I take the argument of the report also to be that once a society begins to become unequal or sort of, you know, dangerously unequal, then that builds. There's a kind of speeding up that occurs. You get the bad politics. The bad politics allows people to get even richer, and it just gets worse and worse. It's like a rock tumbling down a hillside.
Absolutely. Formally, as economists, we describe this as there being multiple equilibrium. One can create a better society, with a more equal society, better economic performance. But if you allow inequality to get out of bounds, it reinforces itself. The economic inequality leads to inevitably inequalities in the political process. And as I say, especially in places where you allow excessive influence of money in politics, that political inequality leads to rules that lead to more economic inequality. And it's a vicious circle. You know, we have democracies, and as long as we have our democracies, more fragile, at least than we realized, we can push back and try to get to that good equilibrium of shared prosperity, inclusive societies, and that's what we're trying to make sure it's true not only within countries, but between countries.
In Australia, there's an argument that is widely supported. It's widely welcomed. An argument that taxes and red tape, that sort of thing, kills aspiration, and that citizens have a right to aspire to be better off, indeed even to become wealthy, and that the state shouldn't stand in their way. As I say, it's politically powerful here. What do you say to that argument?
I'd say that no one is talking about extreme, 95% tax rates. Although, interestingly, in the era after World War II, when our tax rates were very, very high, well over 70%, that was the era of fastest economic growth, not only in the United States, but in many countries around the world. So the conclusion that high taxes lead to low growth is absolutely wrong. In fact, among the successful economies around the world are the Nordic countries that have been marked by high taxes. And they would say that has contributed to their success. Why? Because if you are going to have a successful economy, you need to invest in infrastructure, in education, in technology. If you're going to have your citizens open to new ideas, to globalization, to innovation, they have to feel that they have some degree of social protection, so that actually part of this, you might say, high-performing society, high-performing economy, involves having taxes at least at the rate that can finance these basic public goods that enable a society to work together, and by working together, to work better.
There's something else, though, isn't there, in the example particularly of Norway, that they struck a good deal with the people who are going to drill for oil. And there are several places in your report you talk about countries already poor who strike terrible deals with people who have come to extract their natural resources.
You're absolutely right. You know, one of the big contrast, it's not only striking good deals, it's also using the resources well. So both UK and Norway benefited from the discovery of oil and gas in the North Sea. But Norway decided to be very careful in the usage of those funds, and now has a small country of 4 million, 5 million people, now is sitting on a sovereign wealth fund well over $1 trillion. The UK didn't do that. They squandered that money. Today, their standard of living is low, much lower than in Norway. When at the end of World War II, they were, or before World War II, they were one of the leading economies in the world. But that relates to Australia. One of the amazing things I remember from my last visit to Australia discussions, that basically you were giving away some of your natural resources. You were almost paying people to take away your natural resources. It made absolutely no sense. One of the arguments I put forward was, you know, when you do that, you're actually becoming poorer. Because unless you take the resources that are below the ground, those are assets below the ground, and you reinvest them in assets above the ground, assets like infrastructure, technology, human capital, you're actually squandering your wealth. You're a poor country. What I saw was going on at the time in Australia was that you were giving away your resources without adequate compensation.
Joseph, you've never understood the innate generosity of the Australian people towards international, look, I won't go on further. It's just an area that people have tried to bring you up to date with, and you just refuse to see the warm, fuzzy logic of Australia's attitude to people who come to extract their minerals. Joseph,
these rich corporations, that fuzzy feelings about rich corporations are abroad. I do find it difficult to understand those fuzzy feelings.
Yes, it's a lot of people find them difficult to understand, but they're native to Australia, and therefore we have to respect them. Joseph, thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Well, thank you.
I've been talking to the Nobel laureate economist Joseph Stiglitz about the new report, which is online. It's called the G20 Extraordinary Committee of Independent Experts on Global Inequality. This is Late Night Live. A couple of things for Chatterbox. I now know more clearly the difference between in vitro and in utero, thanks to so many of you helpfully pointing out my stupid error. To be clear, Julian Lisa, now Liberal member for Barara, was in his mother's womb the day Kerr sacked Whitlam, not, as I suggested, in a test tube. I mentioned in passing that slave money built many beautiful houses in Britain. The UK National Trust, that now owns many of them, is, in the face of great opposition, very honestly addressing this issue. And there's a report online. The connections between colonialism and properties now in the care of the National Trust, including links with historic slavery. And that's it for the week. My thanks to producers Catherine Zengerer, Ali Benton, Alex Tai, and our executive producer, Jack Schmidt. Until next week. Thank you.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.